Accession number 17363, Reel 2.
Baraclough, Reel 2.
I tried to give her the impression that things were getting on pretty well, and that we should win the war in the end. Anyway, he said we must be getting on, so we got on our bicycles and carried on to the local police station, and I was taken in there. The commandant of police had been prized from his bed, and he was there to greet me. He said he was very sorry that they'd had to take me in, but there was nothing they could do about it. He brought me cigarettes. I remember the name on the packet very well. They were called Just Love. And he said that they would probably have to keep me there overnight, but the Germans had been informed that I'd been picked up, and they would be coming for me in the event they came the same night. And I'd had a vision of what Germans were like, and I must say that they came up to my imaginings. They were tough-looking men. There were three of them, and they searched me for arms, and took me into their car and whisked me off to local frontier post, and there I was searched again, and my clothes were taken away, and I was put in a cell for the night. I remained there for one night.
Did they say anything to you?
Well, they, as I remember, of the three men who picked me up, they didn't speak English. It was after then, when the following day, I was taken to what I think was an AK-AK base, and I was taken before the commanding officer there, and questioned. Of course, we were only supposed to give name, rank, and number, which is what I did. And they took away various items from me and gave me a receipt for them, which I've still got. And then I was taken back to the frontier post, and later that morning I was taken by car to Utrecht. I remember when we got out of the car and walked to the station in Utrecht, the Dutch people giving the V sign. So that was very heartening. And I was put on a train with the guards and taken up to Amsterdam. And there I was lodged in the military prison. And it was there that I met my first other English POW. I was in a line of cells, I I think it was a military prison of some kind, because we could hear soldiers marching in a space outside somewhere, and singing, as they frequently do, of course, in the German army. And this chap had been had asked to go to the lavatory, and when he came back to his cell, he peeped through my spy hole, and he said, "Hello, who are you?" "I'm Charles Hall." And he was one of the officers who was shot after they escaped in the Great Escape at Sagan. He had been shot down the day after I was, on the 28th of December, because he'd been flying photographic reconnaissance aircraft. He'd been sent to photograph the damage that we'd done over Dusseldorf, and he'd been hit by flak, and he'd bailed out, and so that was his first day as a POW. However, he was there, and there was another chap who was another sergeant. Hall was a POW, he was a pilot officer actually, but I was a sergeant, and there was another sergeant in the cells, a Canadian, and we stayed there for 2 days, and then when they had a group big enough to fill a minibus, I suppose, there were, let me see now, I suppose there were 7 or 8 of us, 2 officers and 5 sergeants. I can't remember now, 5 or 6 anyway. And they took us by bus to the station, and we were taken by rail in reasonable coaches. They were wooden seats, but they weren't bad. we travelled down the Rhine to Frankfurt. An interesting journey. And then in Frankfurt we took a...
Interesting from the war point of view?
Interesting from what we saw, yes. There was, in Cologne in particular, I remember there were signs of bomb damage, which was heartening. But anyway, we carried on to Frankfurt, and we took a local train from there to a place called Oberursel.
Was there any reaction from German civilians as you passed through?
not that I remember. Not at that stage, no. I don't think the bombing had become serious enough for them to be put out by the sight of airmen who had been captured. However, we were taken up to Oberursel, which was the transit camp for airmen who had been captured, and I was put into confinement there for 7 days, interrogation by various people. They obviously had no idea at that stage what I'd been flying in. one chap insisted that I was flying in a Beaufort from St. Eva, which was a coastal command station, and that I'd been dropping torpedoes or something. Anyway, they kept me in this cell for approximately 7 days, and I was photographed and fingerprinted and so on during that time.
What were your tactics in the interrogations?
Well, as I said before, we'd been told that all we were to give them was our name, rank and number, which is what I did. So after I'd been there a week, they put me into the main camp, and I met some of the men who had come down from Amsterdam with me, and other people as well.
In the interrogation, what methods did they use to try to induce you to say more?
Well, they simply persisted with their questions. There was no physical means of getting information from us that I remember. There was nothing to read in the room. It was very bare, and one was left with one's own thoughts. I remember trying to think of the words of songs that were current at that time, and things to keep my brain working anyway. The room wasn't hot, it wasn't cold, it was just bare, and but it wasn't cruel in any way.
Did they adopt any trickery or lay any traps to get you to say anything?
Yes, there was one. They produced a form which they said they had received from the Red Cross, and would I please fill it in? And this, as I remember, gave questions. What is your name of your squadron, your group, your aircraft, and so on? Questions that I obviously couldn't answer, and so I simply slid it back across the table and told them that I couldn't possibly fill it in.
So how did they react to that?
Well, he simply shrugged his shoulders and left it at that. He didn't threaten, as far as I know. He might have said at one stage, "Well, you know, if you want your parents to know that you're here and so on, you'll have to answer these questions." I think they might have said something like that. I don't remember precisely what they said. But when I got into the main camp, I met a number of interesting people. You would certainly have read the story of the wooden horse. This very clever escape that was made at Sagan, Stalag Luft 3. Philpott, one of the men who escaped in the horse, was at Dulag Luft when I was there. I knew his rear gunner, Freddie Smith, very well. He went on with us to the next camp, but Philpott, of course, was an officer and went to Luft 3. Another chap who was there was Marcus Marsh, trainer of Windsor Lad before the war, the horse that won the Derby. And I think he returned to his training of horses after the war, and made quite a name for himself. But it was a small, very civilized little camp was Dulag Luft. And although the beds were very simple and there were bunks, life there wasn't bad. And I was there for about a month.
What impression did Philpott make on you?
I don't remember a conversation with him. I just know that he was there. The chap I had conversations with were Charles Hall, the man who was murdered by the Germans after the Great Escape. Well, at the end of about a month, the camp was full, and it was time for us to move on. Well, normally I think they would have moved us to a camp run by the Luftwaffe, but we did hear that there was an epidemic of typhus in the Luftwaffe camp at that time, so we were sent down into Bavaria to Stalag 7A, which was a French camp. I think there were about 50,000 men attached to the camp. It was a sort of main camp from which working parties were sent out to various places in Germany. Our journey from Dulag Luft to Sevenay was a bit rugged, because it was our first taste of cattle trucks. We were taken in cattle trucks down to Sevenay was in a place called Moosburg near Munich, not very far from Dachau, the concentration camp. And it was the difference was enormous between what life had been like at Dulag Luft and what it was like at 7A. We were pushed into a barrack. The barracks normally housed 200 men, three-tier bunks, and one cold tap at each end of the barrack, and two stoves for 200 men. The stoves you could... the French seemed to have, in some way, obtained the monopoly of these stoves. Anyway, we were a small group of English airmen in one corner of the barrack. I remember I was on the top bunk of three. Just one blanket. It was winter time, of course. It was the end of December, end of January, when we arrived there. And we languished there, because it really was a flea-ridden hole, 7A. Every day we had to take out our blankets and deflee them, because it was so unpleasant. However, we stayed there for, I suppose, from the end of January to the end of August, I suppose, and the vicissitudes of 7A were many. The Germans tried to make us work on camp duties. We knew that we weren't supposed to work because of our rank. We were anyone over the rank of corporal could not be forced to work. We knew that. And the Germans made us repair roads in the camp, go out on potato peeling parties and engage in duties like that. So we resisted this, insisted that it was quite wrong of them to employ us in this way, and we refused to work, and they applied sanctions they made us confined us to our barracks and so on. But in the end we finally managed to persuade them that really they weren't doing the right thing, and that we should be left alone.
So that was successful, was it?
It was successful, yes. Yes, indeed. So,
any thoughts of escape at Moose Park?
Yes, indeed, there were. In fact, on one occasion, a group of RAF men did manage to get out, although most of them were picked up when they got out. It was a good effort, and when they returned, of course, they had spent 28 days in the cooler, which was normal if you got out of the camp. Finally, we were moved on from 7A. We were a small group of about 100 RAF POWs who remained together right through the war. They moved us to 383, Stalag 383.
This apparently is on the 15th of September, according to your record.
Well, that's right, yes. Yes. Those notes are taken from my diary, which I kept, of course. And 383 was certainly a cut above 7A. We were housed in huts, which had been used, I think, by the German army before the war, by Alpine troops. There were huts housing 40 men, so that we settled into these and felt really that we could really organise ourselves and begin a life that was rather more bearable than the one we'd had. And, 383 was a camp for non-workers. It was an army camp, basically. I think finally there were about 8,000 army NCOs in 383 and 100 RAF prisoners. And we stayed there for nearly 2 years.
Why was it a better camp to be in?
It was better. Living conditions were better. It was cleaner. That was the thing, I think, about it. Conditions for washing and keeping one's clothes clean were better there than they had been. We had a washing place. We could wash our clothes and ourselves in better conditions than we had been able to at 7A. And small units of 14 were able to work together. Very often we put all our Red Cross parcels together and arranged work in rotas and so on, and everything was organized in a better way, and we got to know each other very well. Of course, we had a school in the camp, so we could learn. We played a lot of bridge. We had an escape club, and various tunnels were dug, and all the usual activities of a POW camp were carried on there. The entertainment was good. We had a band, and altogether we had a life that kept us occupied. One could walk. We had a field for sporting activities. We could walk around that every day. And in South Germany, the weather wasn't bad. In the summertime, it could be hot and dry. In the winter, it was cold and dry. So we felt really that conditions could be much worse. And we imagined that we would probably have to remain there until the end of the war. However, the time came when the powers that be decided that we ought to be in a proper RAF camp, and we were all moved from there, about 100 of us, up under the Polish border. Now this was lateish 1944.
30th of July, you actually put here.
That's right. And we moved up under the Polish border to a place near Kreuzberg. And
Stalag Luft 7.
Stalag Luft 7. It wasn't ready though. When we arrived there, we were put into huts, and we slept on the floor, and we were there for some weeks until the camp was ready. And then we were put into the camp and given a particular barrack. There were special barracks. They had the floors were built above ground. There was a space under the floor, between the floor and the ground, so that dogs could be put in every night, presumably to stop people from digging tunnels. And the camp was very tight indeed. And we were under the control of the Luftwaffe. We'd always been looked after by the army, but at last we were under the Air Force, the German Air Force. And we were counted twice a day instead of the usual once a day. And
was the regime of the German Air Force much different from the regime of the German Army?
Yes, I think it was somewhat stricter. Certainly, they seemed to be conscious of the fact that RAF personnel were more likely to try to get out than the army were. That was the impression we got anyway, and I think they were probably right. At any rate,